Jonah 1:9-5. Now, the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it, for their evil has come up before me." But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went on board to go with them to Tarshish, away from the presence of the Lord. But the Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, so that the ship threatened to break up. Then the mariners were afraid, and each cried out to his God. And they hurled the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten it for them. But Jonah had gone down into the inner part of the ship, and had lain down and was fast asleep. So the captain came and said to him, "What do you mean, you sleeper? Arise, call out to your God. Perhaps the God will give a thought to us that we may not perish." And they said to one another, "Come, let us cast lots that we may know on whose account the evil has come upon us." So they cast lots, and the lot fell to Jonah. Then they said to him, "Tell us on whose account this evil has come upon us. What is your occupation? Where do you come from? What is your country, and of whose people are you?" And he said to them, "I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." Then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, "What is this that you've done?" For the men knew that he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord, because he had told them. Then they said to him, "What shall we do to you that the sea may quiet down for us?" For the sea grew more and more tempestuous. He said to them, "Pick me up and hurl me into the sea. Then the sea will quieten down for you. For I know it is because of me that this great tempest has come upon you." Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to get back to dry land, but they could not, for the sea grew more and more tempestuous against them. Therefore they called out to the Lord, "O Lord, let us not perish for this man's life, and lay not on us innocent blood, for you, O Lord, have done as it pleases you." So they picked up Jonah, hurled him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. And last verse, the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow up Jonah, and Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and 3 nights. Lots of reactions, I'm sure, as you read that passage represented in the room. There's a chance at the end to ask any questions you might have about things that I don't cover. But I wanted to see that this passage has really got one big thing to say to us about God, about what God is like. That God is irresistible. God is irresistible. Now, I mean that two ways. I mean irresistible like you can't stop him. So imagine this lady, she gets up from her nice fancy train, she goes to the back of the train, and she just starts pushing against the wall, trying to stop the train. Just lock her up in a mental asylum. You can't do it. The train is irresistible. Trains are irresistible. Sometimes resisting them goes badly wrong. But you can use the word irresistible in a different way. I think brunch is irresistible. I just can't keep myself from it. In the Bible, God is irresistible in this second sense as well. That as we see the wonder of what he's like, well, we'll go toward him, not away from him. Now, those two ideas, those two versions of irresistibility, is that currently what you have in your head as you think about God? Maybe for many of us, no. Some of us will think, well, God's not irresistible. He's just some kind of, more like a Lego, a Brio train, trying to resist him. It's easy. Everyone seems to resist God, and God doesn't seem to do anything about it. He's irresistible, no. Or maybe we think, well, no, he's not irresistible in a lovely food kind of a way. He's more Rivita, he's boring and plain, and I avoid him as much as I possibly can. Well, I wanted to see in this passage, God is irresistible in both these ways. In this one story, God paints a picture of what he's truly like, that we'd see how irresistible he truly is. Verse 1, look with me. Now, the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, "Arise, Go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it, for their evil has come up before me. We'll get to Jonah's resistance in a moment, but just to get the context of this, we need to get Nineveh's resistance first. So Nineveh are God resistors. Nineveh eventually became the capital of the Assyrian Empire, and the Assyrians were the bully superpowers of the day. Before Jonah's day, an Assyrian king seems to have swept through northern Israel and demanded tribute and left a trail of destruction in his wake. Let me read to you from an Assyrian account of their own invasion. The king says, "By the commands of the great gods, I moved out of the city of Nineveh and approached the city Suru. The nobles of the city came out to me to save their lives. I flayed as many nobles as had rebelled against me and draped their skin over the wall of Nineveh." These are not pretty pictures of people. My slides are out of sync. Apologies for that. By the command of the great God, these guys were evil. What does it say in 1 verse 2? Their evil has come up before me, God says. They lived in evil. And yet God tells Jonah to call out against their evil. Assyria is attempting resistance against God. But the book of Jonah invites us to see reality. That there is a God, and he does see evil. He's sitting on the throne. He's taking notes. The book of Revelation, chapter 20, pictures God as sitting there, and books are brought out before him, books of deeds brought out on Judgment Day. He is the one who sees all. Nineveh resists God. But the main attempt at resistance comes from Jonah. So God has a plan for Jonah, doesn't he? Go to the city of Nineveh and preach against it. Jonah was a prophet to northern Israel, to the king Jeroboam II. He gets one positive mention in the book of 2 Kings. It's the only thing we know about him other than the book of Jonah. Jeroboam restored the borders of Israel. The kingdom grew back out. According to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke by his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet who was from Gath-Hepher. So Jonah's job then had been to declare that God was going to bless Israel. And he seems to be pretty happy with that as a job. But when it comes to a different job, no, Jonah resists. Verse 3, Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. There's Joppa, western Israel. And then Nineveh's all the way over the up top right, northeast. He goes to what people think is southern Spain. So he goes to Tarshish. He gets as far away as he possibly can. It'd be like someone saying, take the gospel to Norway, and instead he says, okay, I'm going to get on a boat to the US. I want to get as far away from this as possible. Jonah is resisting God's plan for him, but also God's plan for Nineveh. We've got to see where the book is going for Jonah's flight to make sense, because he explains it at the end of the book, why he flees. So have a look down in chapter 3, verse 10. So you just need to flick over the page for that. Jonah eventually goes, preaches to Nineveh, and they repent. So 3 verse 10, when God saw what Nineveh did, how they turned from their evil way, God relented of the disaster that he said he would do to them, and he did not do it. How does Jonah feel about it? 4 verse 1, it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he was angry. And he prayed to the Lord and said, O Lord, is not this what I said when I was yet in my country? That is why I made haste to flee to Tarshish, for I knew that you are a gracious God, merciful, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, and relenting from disaster. It's quite strong, isn't it? Maybe Jonah had just heard about Assyria and Nineveh by reputation. Maybe they'd storm straight on through his hometown. But whichever it was, he didn't want God to show mercy to Nineveh. Most people, most of the time, seem to want God to be some doddery grandfather. So he's just there with a smile and a bit of wisdom and maybe some inheritance, but most of the time just stays out of your life. But sometimes people want a God, people do want a God who is a judge, who judges evil. So I was reading, even the Guardian newspaper wants that. So I was reading a Guardian newspaper article a while ago about Jimmy Savile, and the editorial just in the wake of the Jimmy Savile scandal did some horrific things to children and disabled people. The article said this, you know, non-Christian writing, if there is one thing to make the most benign agnostics wish that there were a God to punish sinners with eternal torment, it is the contemplation of history's monsters. Maybe it's nearer this perspective that Jonah is aligning himself with. At points in the Bible does use judgment as comfort. So if you looked in the New Testament letter of 2 Thessalonians, the Thessalonian church are this kind of persecuted minority, almost like Christians in Iraq under Islamic State were. And Paul says to them, well, God considers it just to repay in eternity with affliction those who afflict you. Justice can be a comfort, but you've got to be really careful in the Bible how you do this, because who's the one writing 2 Thessalonians? Is this guy Paul? What did Paul do before he was a Christian? He went around persecuting Christians. As the first Christian martyr died, Paul was there holding the jackets of the people throwing the stones, like he was in charge. So we gave growth groups a big push recently. You know, come study the wonderful book of Romans. But it's written by Paul as well. Jonah hated that God might show Nineveh mercy. And yet, as you go through the Bible, you realize God is just, and yet he delights to show mercy to the undeserving. This is a guy called Jay Mariner. We had an interview and talk with him on Wednesday lunchtime as part of our work with people who work in Canary Wharf. And Jay's story is pretty interesting, engaging, colourful. He grew up, as he described himself, just a good, honest drug dealer. He was sitting there in prison once going, God, you owe me. How dare you? All I've done is sell drugs. And yet, out of that context, God chose to show mercy to Jay. So his wife became a Christian through a local church, and she sent round the heavy mob. Well, she sent round the pastor with his Bible and some other people to sit in his house and talk to him about Jesus. The first time the pastor walked in the house, Jay turned round to him and said, look, if you don't get out, I'm going to roll you up. I'm going to post you back out the letterbox. He was a hard guy. And yet God has chosen to show mercy to Jay. Jay has become a Christian. He's now planted a church in Brixton and works alongside people coming out of that same background. God is a God who shows mercy. People from all walks of life. People who don't want to stay as they are. What is church to be like? Is church just to be a little community of the squeaky clean, a place to hang out with my expat community or find lovely little friends for my kids? It's not. Real Christianity forms a community of people who know they need mercy. People who know they didn't deserve it. People from all walks of life, with all kinds of pasts. People who don't want to stay as they are. But it's a call to come as we are and start from there. The story of Jay Mariner is interesting because he says he doesn't know exactly when he became a Christian. It was a kind of 2-year period where he was going to church quite a lot. And he just says, you know, at the end of that 2-year period, I knew I was loving Jesus and trusting Jesus and wanting to serve him. Yet it must have been a pretty bumpy road to be part of that church as they saw Jay coming to faith. Who would we want mercy to go to? Jonah attempts resistance. God takes him and us on this journey to teach us he is irresistible. That when we see not just his power, he's irresistible that way, but when we see his mercy, when we see our own need of mercy, well, then we'll listen up to him. Next point, resistance is futile. Resistance is futile. So there you go for you Trekkie fans out there. Resistance is futile. But you could say resistance is comic. Resistance is just comic, isn't it? So look at what Jonah says he believes about God in verse 9. So 1 verse 9, what does he believe about God? He says, I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. And then what does he do? He tries to run away from God in a boat. It's comic, isn't it? It's just stupid that you would try and resist God's will. Resistance is impossible. So verse 4, Jonah tries to run, but the Lord hurls a great wind upon the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, so that the ship threatened to break up. So the scene recently from the Mangkhut typhoon in hitting Hong Kong, and just a trail of devastation it left in its wake. Jonah wanted to run away. God said no. And his no meant no. But it's not just Jonah who's trying to resist God in this passage, actually. Verse 5, the mariners, I'd say, are trying to resist God too. Verse 5, the mariners are afraid, and here will be a key line, each cried out to his God. So the sailors are people who resist the true God. In a sense, they're caught in the crossfire. Yes, the storm is God's actions, primarily at Jonah, but they're also God resistors themselves. So they serve false gods who are no gods, who just cannot stand before the real God. And the Bible says that that's what each of us do, me and you. We know deep down God deserves our all, and yet we find that truth too inconvenient. Instead, we would rather trust false gods or false ideologies as our functional source of help, as the thing that we'd run to and turn to and look for help from. Maybe another religion, or maybe just other things. Once the sailors' pagan deities let them down, then they try their real god, their functional god, their cargo. So verse 5, they hurl their cargo that was in the ship into the sea. So it's a think of the value of that. See what they're trying to throw at it to gain some control. Yet it's all useless. In verse 13, they try their own strength. They try as hard as they can. The men rowed hard to get back to land, but they could not. Whichever false god, whichever false ideology we line up against God, it's back to the sumo wrestlers. It's futile. Resistance is futile. The ship threatens to break up, and the longer Jonah resists, the nearer he gets to the grave. Did you see this? So watch out for the idea of Jonah going down as I read this. Verse 3, Jonah went down to Joppa. He found a ship going to Tarshish, so he paid the fare, and literally it reads, he went down into the boat. Verse 5, but Jonah had gone down into the inner part of the ship and laid down and was fast asleep. And in the end, he's going to be cast down into the sea and he's going to sink down to the bottom of the sea. The more he rebels, the nearer he gets to the grave. It looks hopeless. The sailors start stumbling around looking for answers. Verse 7, they say to one another, come, let us cast lots that we may know on whose account this evil has come upon us. And God is merciful to show them an answer, right? Lots wouldn't normally do that for you. Verse 7, they cast lots and the lot fell on Jonah. They pile him with questions. Where do you come from? What's your country? Whose people are you? The only question he can't bear to answer is the one, what's your occupation? Prophet of God. But he does his job and speaks to them of Yahweh. He says, I am a Hebrew, verse 9. I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. So many of these details rebuke Jonah and the nation of Israel he represents. These pagan sailors know so little, yet they get the implications way quicker than Jonah, right? Verse 10, they are exceedingly afraid. What is this you have done to us? Resistance is futile. How do we apply this? What does it mean to us? Well, we're not to conclude every suffering I experience is a storm God sends because I'm running from him. So this is Jonah's experience written for us all to learn from. So if we're forgetting God's power or mercy at the moment, God has sent us the book of Jonah to call us to remember. We're to conclude that God and his plans are irresistible. So God has planned for us to die once and then after that to face judgment. That plan is irresistible. God has planned that in the new creation, he will have a great multitude from every tribe and tongue and nation and people around his throne praising his name. That plan is unstoppable. We're not to resist it like the car stuck to the front. We're to get on board with the plan. We're to get on board with where the plan is going. Sit back and enjoy the ride, you could say, or maybe better, you should say, be like the servant on the train, the one who gets where the train is going and listens to God and serves him. God is irresistible. We can't stop him. And yet the bigger question is this. Why resist this God of mercy? Why would we want to resist this God of mercy? So here they are, all in the midst of God's judgment. What will happen? Are they all about to go down, or is there hope? Well, there's mercy to the sailors. You get this breathless exchange, you know, shout. You imagine them sort of shouting to each other, shouting at Jonah in the midst of the storm. What are we to do? What should we do? Verse 12, Jonah shouts back, pick me up, hurl me into the sea. They're petrified about it, but verse 15, they eventually do it. They pick up Jonah and they hurled him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. The sailors were saved. God showed mercy to them. As Jonah is thrown into God's judgment, mercy comes to those pagan rejecters of God. This is a little foretaste of the mercy God is going to show to Nineveh. So the sailors say, who knows, perhaps he will show mercy. It's exactly the same words that the king of Nineveh says. Who knows, perhaps God will show mercy. It's a little foretaste of that, but it's also a foretaste of the mercy God will show us at the cross. Mark has mentioned it earlier. In Matthew 12, Jesus says, he is one greater than Jonah. Like Jonah's story is a little model of the greater reality he's going to bring. The Channel 4 advertising is clever if you've seen it before. So at points, it just you can't quite make out what it is, and often the camera is panning past it, and you just can't see what it is. It just looks like a bunch of shapes. But then when you get to the exact right moment and it all lines up, suddenly you can see the Channel 4 emerge. It's a bit like that, only a bit like that, with the cross here in Jonah. So at lots of other points, the shapes don't quite line up. But at this one moment, as the man of God is thrown into the judgment of God, people who deserved God's judgment, the sailors, are rescued from it. That's what happens at the cross. That's at the heart of the Christian faith, that Jesus says that I will be thrown into God's judgment. I will take that, and as I die, you can be free. I will take that judgment. That judgment can be removed from you. So Jonah was afraid of God's mercy, and yet this is great news. This is the gracious and merciful God, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, relenting from disaster. So God is not just unstoppable, his mercy is irresistibly good. If you spend your life looking down on other people, mercy doesn't sound that exciting. But if you know that you need mercy, if you know you've mucked it up, this is irresistible. God is ready to show mercy. Not here meaning we can't resist mercy. But we can get into that another time. But here just meaning, look how wonderful it is. Doesn't that make us want to dive in? The sailor's response is a model for us. So verse 16, the men feared the Lord exceedingly, and they offer a sacrifice to the Lord and make vows to him. They model to us what humanity should do, to trust him and to pledge to serve him. But not just the sailors, let's think about Nineveh and Jonah as we come into land. Mercy to them. How does the story go? Well, the story finishes, verse 17, there he is, Jonah, being rescued by the fish. So the Lord appoints a great fish to swallow up Jonah, and Jonah is in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. For the biologists out there, okay, maybe the miracle isn't just that the fish arrives at the exact moment. Maybe the miracle is he survives the digestive juices as well, or whatever it is. God does a miracle. Jonah is rescued. And Jonah is returned back to his path. In chapter 3, God says, Jonah, go to Nineveh. This time, Jonah thinks, okay, I'm going to go. And it's God's plan to get mercy to Nineveh. It's not thrown by Jonah's rejection. God still gets the message so that Nineveh could get mercy. God is showing mercy to Nineveh. He is the great evangelist. He's not thwarted by the disobedience of his people. And yet, the primary character in this book, after God, is Jonah, right? It's God's dealings with Jonah. If you were this all-powerful God and you wanted to get your message to Nineveh, how would you do it? Probably just boom it out from the sky. I definitely wouldn't stick with Jonah when he says no. I'd just choose a different person who is more obedient. And yet God plans this whole seemingly convoluted, maybe, series of events because he wants to show mercy to Jonah. He doesn't just show mercy to Jonah by rescuing him from the sea, which he does. He shows mercy to Jonah by teaching him, by revealing more to him. In one sense, God is very ungentle with him, and yet in another sense, God graciously calls Jonah back to himself. Jonah gets in this story powerful, visual, tangible reminders that he is someone desperately in need of mercy. God is trying to say, Jonah, do you get that you need mercy? If you get that, why do you want to withhold mercy from somebody else? If you need mercy, let me show you need it. Well, come with me on mission. Be ready to hold out mercy to others. Whoever they are, whatever they've done. We've got some guys, they're Bangladeshi Muslims, and they come and sit on the barge outside, on the benches outside the barge. You might see them there on a Wednesday night. And sometimes we've been able to have good conversations with them about Christianity. But there are a lot of... had quite a lot of criminal damage. We're never quite sure who it is that's done it, but like £200 worth of barge signs have been broken. And it's easy to go, The first thing that I think when I see people sitting on the bench outside the barge is just, I wish they were somewhere else. Because I wish our signs didn't get broken. And yet God would train us to say, no, the first thing we should think is, God, I needed mercy. Could I be a part of mercy going to them as well? God is irresistible. He will get his word to the world. God's mercy is irresistible. We're to receive it, to rejoice in it, and share it. Let me lead us in a prayer. Father, please take what we've learned from this book today. Please take our sight of your character. Please would we rejoice to receive mercy. Please would we rejoice to show mercy to others. Please would we rejoice to have other people hear of mercy too. In Jesus' name, amen.